With infinite complacence, people went to and fro over the earth about their little affairs, serene in the assurance of their dominion over this small, spinning fragment of solar driftwood, which by chance or design, man has inherited out of the dark mystery of time and space.
Why don't you ask me what it feels like to be a freak?
The power of a new generation.
Everyone here is mad.
Greetings, and you are listening to Savage Science Radio here at Jackalope 105 FM, and I am your host, Tracy Savage. Let's have some music to start this night off right. Bunch of science coming at you from one end of this universe to the other this week. Let's just dive right in with one of the finest meteor showers of 2010. The Geminids had put on quite a rousing show the night of December 13th to 14th. One of the most prolific annual meteor showers makes its appearance in mid-December. The Geminid shower peaks the night of December 13th to the 14th. Although many people consider it to be a poor cousin to August Perseid shower, the Geminids put on usually a much better show. This year, observers can expect to see upward of 100 shooting stars per hour, an average of nearly 2 per minute under a dark sky. Conditions should be wonderful for the Geminids this year, says Astronomy Magazine senior editor Michael Buckich. The first quarter moon sets around midnight local time, leaving the prime viewing hours after midnight free from any unwanted natural lighting. The only potential drawback is cloud cover, which unfortunately tends to be fairly common this time of year. Rates for this shower remain decent a day on either side of the peak, so target the morning of December 13th or 15th if the weather looks bad on the 14th. Any stray light in the sky tends to drown out fainter meteors, so finding an observing site far from the lights of the city is best. A large field is ideal because you can then let your eyes roam across the whole sky. December nights tend to be cold, however, so bundle up in layers. Reclining in a lawn chair is a great way to take in a lot of the sky at once, but be sure to get up and walk around occasionally, and it also helps drink some hot coffee or tea. The Geminids begin as tiny specks of dust that hit the Earth's atmosphere at 78,000 miles per hour, or 126,000 kilometers per hour, vaporizing from friction with the air and leaving behind the streaks of light we call meteors. The meteors appear to radiate from the constellation Gemini the Twins, hence their name, near the bright stars Castor and Pollux. This spot, called the Radiant, remains visible all night and passes nearly overhead around 2 a.m. local time. Although the meteors seem to originate in Gemini, they can appear anywhere in the sky and actually leave longer trails the farther they are from the radiant. Here's a couple fast facts. The dust particles that create the Geminids don't originate in a comet as those in most meteor showers do. Studies of Geminid meteors show that these particles coincide with the orbit of an asteroid called Phaethon. Perhaps this object was once a comet that passed through the inner solar system so many times that it lost all of its ices, leaving behind a rocky object that only appears to be an asteroid. Although 78,000 miles per hour may seem fast, Geminid meteors are slower than those in most other annual showers. The speed champions are the Leonids of November, which hit our atmosphere at 159,000 miles per hour, or 256,000 kilometers per hour. If you'd like to expand your observing with these tools that you can find in Astronomy Magazine, look for the video, How to Observe Meteor Showers with Michael Buckich, who is the senior editor that we mentioned before, or look up Stardome. It locates the Leonid meteor showers radiant in your night sky with their interactive star chart. You can also sign up for their weekly email newsletter there. And if you want to look at earthsky.org, they have 10 tips for watching the Geminid meteor shower, and it's very helpful in case you have never had a chance to do it before. And you can bring a friend, which helps because then one person can look at one side of the sky and the other person can look at the other side of the sky. So good luck, and if you've got a camera, put it on your night setting and have a ball. Well, it looks like we actually have an update from the NASA news conference last week, and it has to do with, just like they said, the definition of life has expanded. Of course, it was a little confusing because they talked about extraterrestrial, and here is a little clip from the BBC and an interview with Dr. Michio Kaku.
These microscopic bacteria look ordinary enough, but they're actually causing scientists to rewrite the very definition of life. NASA has discovered a weird new life form, not on some distant star, but right here on planet Earth, in California. Where else, you might say? Mono Lake, close to Yosemite National Park. What's weird about it is that these bacteria thrive on something that usually kills. Well, for more on the significance of this finding, I'm now joined from New York by physicist Professor Michio Kaku. Great to have you back on the program, sir.
Great to be on.
Now tell me, what is so weird and what is so new about this life form?
This is a spectacular result. It means that every single biology textbook on the planet Earth has to be revised. Even the very definition of what we consider life has to be changed. All life depends on DNA, we're told. But DNA can be rearranged to convert a yeast cell into an elephant, into a human. But now we have found a new form of DNA.
Okay, and what I mentioned earlier in my introduction there, trying to build up a bit of suspense in all this, is that this thing thrives on something that usually kills, and that would be?
Arsenic. We're talking about life made out of carbon, nitrogen, oxygen, phosphorus. However, phosphorus has been replaced by arsenic, which was once thought to be impossible. And that's why this is a game changer. It means that extreme environments can create extreme forms of life that we've never seen before. And it means that when we explore outer space, we have to be much more open-minded about the kinds of life forms we may encounter. Because if we encounter this in California, you can imagine what we might find in outer space.
Well, maybe not, actually. So in other words, this particular bacteria thinks of arsenic as candy, right?
That's right. In other words, arsenic can masquerade like phosphorus. They're very similar chemically. One is just below the other on the periodic chart of elements. And so you can slip arsenic into a molecule. However, arsenic compounds are unstable in water, and that's why arsenic can kill you. However, these bacteria, for reasons we don't quite understand, can absorb arsenic without becoming unstable. And that's a new result not found in the chemistry books.
So if that's the case here, what are the implications for looking for life elsewhere in the universe? I mean, have we been looking for the wrong kind of life, and is the bracket now wide open?
We have to throw the net a lot wider. Looking for life on Titan, a moon of Saturn, or Europa, a moon of Jupiter, we have to realize that these molecules are quite adaptive. In over billions of years, they may hit upon a new combination of molecules and atoms which allow for DNA-like molecules to replicate in extreme hostile environments. For example, even life on Earth probably did not first evolve on the surface of the Earth. The very first DNA probably evolved on the bottom of the ocean near volcano vents. So even our own ancestry points to extreme environments creating extreme forms of life.
Yeah. Fascinating stuff. Professor Kako, thank you very much indeed.
Mm-hmm.
Now, of course, if you want to read more about this discovery, you can go to science.nasa.gov and look up the news story about the arsenic-based life. We are calling this newly discovered microbe strain GFAJ-1 and is a member of a common group of bacteria, the gamma proteobacteria. The actual links to the papers are found on there. You can see some of the images, and you can see geomicrobiologist Felicia Wolf-Simon, who was the person who was at the NASA news conference last week.
This year for Christmas, there's something I'd really like. So if you're up there somewhere, Santa, please don't bring me another bike. And I don't play much basketball, but there's something kind of special that I want most of all. I want an alien for Christmas. We'll be right back.
we have a couple stories in the math news. Math puzzles' oldest ancestors took form on Egyptian papyrus. I met a man with seven wives. You may know the sing-song quiz, but you might not know this, that it began with ancient Egypt's early math-filled manuscripts. It's true. That very British-sounding St. Ives conundrum, the one where the seven wives each have seven sacks containing seven cats who each have seven kilts, and you have to decide how many are going to St. Ives. And that's a decidedly archaic antecedent. An Egyptian document more than 3,600 years old, the Rind Mathematical Papyrus, contains a puzzle of seven that bears an uncanny likeness to the St. Ives riddle. It has mice and barley, not wives and sacks, but the gist is similar. Seven houses have seven cats that each eat seven mice that would each eat seven grains of barley. Each barley grain would have produced seven hecate of grain. A hecate was a unit of volume roughly 1.3 gallons. The goal? To determine how many things are described. The answer? 19,607. The Rind Papyrus, which dates back to 1650 BCE, is one of the several precocious papyri and other artifacts displaying Egyptian mathematical ingenuity. There is the Moscow Mathematical Papyrus held at the Pushkin State Museum of Fine Arts in Moscow, the Egyptian Mathematical Leather Roll, which along with the Rind Papyrus is housed at the British Museum, and the Antmim Wooden Tablets at the Museum of Egyptian Antiquities, of course that's in Cairo. They include methods of measuring a ship's mast and rudder, calculating the volume of cylinders and truncated pyramids, dividing grain quantities into fractions, and verifying how much bread to exchange for beer. They even compute a circle's area using an early approximation of pi. They use 256 over 81, which is about 3.16 instead of pi's value of 3.14159 dot dot dot. It all goes to show that making puzzles is the most ancient of all instincts, says Marcel Donzi, a puzzle expert and anthropology professor at the University of Toronto, who calls documents like the Rind Papyrus the first puzzle books in history. Dr. Dan Z says that people of all eras and cultures gravitate toward puzzles because puzzles have solutions. Other philosophical puzzles of life do not, he continued. When you do get it to go, aha, there it is, damn it, and it gives you some relief. But the Egyptian puzzles were not just recreational diversions seeking comforting illusions of competence. They were serious about their mission. In the Rind Papyrus, the scribe, also known as Ames, introduces roughly 85 problems by saying that he is presenting the, quote, correct method of reckoning for grasping the meaning of things and knowing everything that is, obscurities, and all secrets, unquote. The documents were practical guides to navigating a maturing civilization and an expanding economy. Egypt was going from a centralized, structured world to partially being decentralized, says Milo Gardner, an amateur decoder of Egyptian mathematical tests who has written extensively about them. They had an economic system that was run by an absentee landowners and paid people in units of grain in order to make it fair to have the exact weights and measures. They were trying to figure out a way to evenly divide the hecate so that they could use it as a unit of currency. So the Akhmim tablets, nearly 4,000 years old, contains a list of servants' names along with a series of computations concerning how a hecate of grain can be divided by 3, 7, 10, 11, and 13. The Egyptian mathematical leather roll, also from about 1650 BCE, is generally considered a kind of practice test for students to learn how to convert fractions into sums or other fractions. The Rind Papyrus contains geometry problems that compute the slopes of pyramids and the volume of various shaped granaries. Now, the Moscow Papyrus from about 1850 BCE has about 25 problems, including ways to measure ship's parts and find the surface area of a hemisphere and the area of triangles. Especially interesting are the problems that calculate how efficient a laborer was by how many logs he carried or how many sandals he could make and decorate. or the problems that involve a PEFSU, a unit measuring the strength or weakness of beer or bread based on how much grain is used to make it. One problem calculates whether it's right to exchange 100 loaves of 20 PEFSU bread for 10 jugs of 4 PEFSU malt date beer. After a series of steps, the papyrus proclaims, according to one translation, "Behold, the beer quantity is found to be correct." The problems in these ancient texts are not difficult by modern mathematical standards. The challenge for scholars has come in deciphering what the problems are saying and checking their accuracy. Some of the numerical equivalents are written in a symbolic system called the Eye of Horus, based on a drawing representing the eye of the sky god Horus depicted as a falcon. Sections of the falcon's eye are used to represent fractions, 1/2, 1/4, and so on up to 1/64. Scholars have found few errors in the problems, and Ames even wrote an incorrect number in his St. Ives problem, but overall, the equations were considered remarkably accurate. The practical answers are solved, Mr. Gardner said. What is unsolved about them is the actual thinking in the scribe's head. We don't know exactly what he thought of it. If you'd like to know more about this, you can go into the website for these where these antiquities are held, or you can look it up on NewYorkTimes.com. And another cool math story in the news: teen mathletes do battle at Algorithm Olympics. Neil Wu's last chance for international glory, maybe America's too, begins with a sound like a hippo crunching through a field of dry leaves, the sound of 315 computer prodigies at 315 workstations ripping into 315 gray envelopes in unison. You have 5 hours. A voice booms across the packed gymnasium. Good luck. At his desk on the gym floor, Wu, age 18, pushes his glasses up on his nose and squints. He shouldn't need luck. This is a coding computation. The International Olympiad in Informatics, held in August at the University of Waterloo in Ontario, Canada, and Wu is one of the world's top competition programmers. He just graduated from Baton Rouge Magnet High School in Louisiana. His parents are chemical engineers, originally from Shanghai. Although Wu was born in the U.S. in 7th grade, he took his first place in a nationwide contest for middle schoolers called Math Counts. There is a Neil Wu fan club on Facebook that celebrates his, quote, awesome math skills, unquote. Yeah, according to Rob Kolstad, the U.S. team's 57-year-old head coach, Wu is merely very good at math. His true gift is for creative problem solving with code. In 2008, the first year he competed at the 101, he finished 10th out of 300 contestants. In 2009, he moved up to 7th place. Since then, he has competed in 6 coding contests run by Kolstad's organization, the USA Computing Olympiad. He won 3 of them with perfect scores. Wu has the relaxed disposition of a star athlete. He's confident without ever letting on that he's America's great nerd hope. I hate to say that he's the Tiger Woods of computer programming, Kolstad says, but he shares the properties of cool, calm under pressure, and consistent performance. If you want to see more about this story, it's pretty cool because there's lots of details and graphs and all sorts of neat things, and blow by blow of what went on during this last competition, go to www.wired.com and look up teen mathlete. Congratulations, Mr. Wu. And speaking of games and young people, we have a special presentation for you from Suspense Theater all the way back from 1955. Zero Hour is our presentation this evening, and it's all about Invasion, which is the newest game sweeping the nation. Mink and her friends claim to be working with an invisible friend, Drill, on a Martian invasion of Earth. Is Invasion just the harmless product of a child's imagination, or is it something far more deadly? This is one of the most controversial stories ever written by the master of fantasy, Mr. Ray Bradbury. Stay tuned. It's next.
I have fallen from grace, and my And now, tonight's presentation of radio's outstanding theater of thrills, Suspense. Tonight, Suspense brings you a repeat performance of one of the most controversial plays ever presented over your radio. It is called Zero Hour by Ray Bradbury. Starring Miss Eza Ashdown, here is tonight's Suspense play, Zero Hour.
What a game. Such excitement they hadn't known in years. Mink talked earnestly to someone near the rose bush, though no one was there. Then the two little girls, shouting, laughing at each other, such fun, such tremulous joy. Mink ran into the house all dirt and sweat. For her few years, she was loud and strong and definite. And her mother, Mrs. Morris, peeling vegetables at the sink, watched with amusement as her daughter threw into a sack old pots and tools and things which were relegated to child play.
Oh, my goodness, Mink, what's going on?
Oh, the most exciting game ever, just ever.
Oh?
It's all right, I take these things, Mom.
Well, just don't dent them and it's all right.
Thanks, Mom, we won't. Bye.
All right, dear. Oh, what's the name of the game, dear?
Invasion.
Invasion?
Invasion. And in the garden now, a serious concentration. Mink with an assortment of pots, pans, and wrenches, forks, spoons. And her friend Anna, a little younger, tongue in teeth, taking notes on a pad.
This, this, and this. What's it say next?
Wait a minute, Mink.
Well, hurry up.
4, 9, 7, A, and B, and X.
4, 9, 7, A, and B, and X.
A fork and a string and a hexagonal.
A fork and a string and a hexagonal. What do we do next, Mr. Drill?
And then Mink talking to the rosebush again. And to her own satisfaction, at least, receiving some kind of answer which she relayed to Anna.
Triangle.
How do you spell it?
Oh, any old way. Doesn't matter. Now write beam.
I haven't got triangle yet.
Well, hurry. 0 hours by 5 o'clock. We haven't got all day.
Then time out from invasion for lunch. Mink bolted down the soup and coincidentally crammed a sandwich into her mouth.
Now you slow down, Mink. Whatever's waiting will wait a few minutes longer.
But I can't. Drill's waiting for me.
Drill? Well, that's a peculiar name. Is he a new boy in the neighborhood, dear?
He's new, all right.
Well, I don't think I've ever seen him. Which one is Drill?
Oh, he's just around. You'll make fun. Everybody makes fun. All the kids do.
Well, I don't think that's very nice. Is Drill shy?
Well, yes, in a way. I don't know. I gotta go now, Mama, if we're gonna have the invasion.
Now, you finish your milk, miss. Who's invading what?
Martians invading Earth from up there.
Oh, I see. And Drill's a Martian?
I think so. He's had a very hard time getting here.
I should imagine.
They couldn't figure out a way to attack Earth. How to get in or something. And Drill says they have to do it by surprise. And even get help from your enemy.
Oh, a fifth column, huh?
Uh-huh. And all this time they haven't been able to figure out how to attack until one day they thought of children.
Well, that was bright of them.
And they thought of how grown-ups are so busy, they never look under rose bushes or on lawns.
Oh, that's where Drill is now, under the rose bush?
Uh-huh, with all his friends, too. And there's something about kids under 11 with imagination. It's real funny to hear Drill talk.
Well, it must be. You better run along out if you want to have your invasion before dark. Oh, and bath tonight. School tomorrow, you know.
Drill says I won't have to take any more baths.
Oh, he does he?
And we can stay up till 10 o'clock.
Well, your friend Mr. Drill had better mind his P's and Q's, or I'm going to call up his
mother. That's just it. Drill says you're dangerous because you don't believe in Martians, just like you think Drill's a kid. Well, he's not. And they're going to let us run the world when they get in, all of us kids. And I might even be queen.
Well, that's nice, dear. Now run along.
Mom?
What is it, dear?
Mom, when the invasion comes, we'll have to get rid of you and Daddy. But I'll be sure it won't hurt very much.
Well, thanks. Thanks a lot. Hello?
Hello, Mary. How are things in New York?
Oh, Helen, how nice. Are you in town?
Oh, no, I'm in Danbury. I was just thinking of you and thought I'd call.
Oh, it's long distance, though. You shouldn't.
Oh, I can afford 3 minutes. How's Henry?
Fine. And Bill?
Oh, just fine. What about Mink?
Oh, wonderful. Noisier than ever. Oh, she's got a new game now. It's taken the place of hopscotch. Invasion.
Is she playing that, too?
Well, yes. Are yours?
Same thing. Some kind of geometric jacks, I suppose. Isn't it a scream? You know, all the kids their age are playing it up here. Timmy's got a crush on some guy named Drill. I think that's what it is.
Oh, it must be a new password. Mink likes him, too.
Well, I didn't know it got to New York. Word of mouth, I suppose. You know, kids. Funniest thing, I got a letter from my sister in Boston. She says her kids are playing it, too. It's just sweeping the country.
Well, I wonder where they learned it.
Don't ask me. All I know is what Timmy told me at lunch. 0 hours at 5 o'clock.
When?
Today. That's when the invasion's going to be. Oh, these kids and their imagination.
And they talked a little more. Schoolgirl friends. Casual woman talk. But Mrs. Morris was thoughtful. She was thinking of other things, of adults, of children with imagination, rose bushes, dimensions. She thought of how much she had forgotten about being a child. And she wondered about
not
Mink
know,
and all the kids
so
who were at that moment
called.
Playing Invasion.
And a kiss for Mink.
I will, and to Bill and the kids.
Thanks. Bye.
Goodbye.
An hour drowsed by. It was 3 o'clock. There was an occasional hum inside the coolness of the house as a car passed outside. The street was lined with good, green, and peaceful trees. And all across the city, in other gardens, in other places, children under 11 were excitedly playing a game, talking to rose bushes and grass lawns, trees and shrubs. Even children in apartment houses, high in the air, conferring with potted plants, cactus, and ivy. Mrs. Morris finished her housework and went to the kitchen.
Oh, hello, dear.
Hi, Mom. Can I have a glass of water?
Of course, I'll get it.
Pi r squared, 1/7. A over 56 to the 7th degree, x t 7.
What, dear?
Oh, nothing, Mom.
Oh, here you are.
Thanks.
How are things going?
Huh?
The, invasion.
Oh, that.
Yes, that.
Almost finished. When everything's right, Drill said we should be ready on time.
5 o'clock?
That's right. How'd you know?
Helen called me from Danbury. She says that Timmy's playing it, too.
Hey, that's keen.
I guess all the kids are, aren't they?
No, not all of them. Not guys like Jimmy Wood and Bob Wilson. They're growing up and they make fun of us. They're worse than parents. They just won't believe in Drill. They're so smart just because they're growing up. You'd think they'd know better. They were little only a couple years ago. Well, we'll get rid of them first. Drill says it's okay to kill them first.
Mink, I don't like that kind of talk. Do you hear me? I don't like it at all.
Oh,
now,
Mom.
I mean it. You keep on that way and there'll be no more playing. You'll have to tell Anna to go home and you'll stay inside until bedtime.
I'm sorry.
Well, I should think so.
Thanks for the water, Mom.
Mink.
Yes, Ma?
What did those numbers mean?
What numbers?
Those numbers you were saying to yourself before.
Oh, that. They're the things we have to do to get Drill and his friends out. That's all.
Look, dear, why don't you and Anna go down to the drugstore and get some ice cream? You don't even have to use your allowance. I'll pay for it.
Haven't got time, Mom. Thanks.
Well, I'd never believe I'd hear you say that.
I gotta go now, Mom.
Oh, wait a minute. Mink, I want you to tell me the truth. What is this invasion silliness?
It isn't silly. It's just a game, that's all. Mom, we're just playing an invasion. Excuse me, I gotta get back now. I'll see you later.
It was a game called Invasion. Mrs. Morris's little girl, Mink, was playing it. So was Mink's friend Anna, and all the other children under 11. It was called Invasion, and 0 hour was to be at 5 o'clock. Mrs. Morris was disturbed. She wasn't sure why, but there was something, something about parents shutting ears and eyes to what was happening. And because she was disturbed, she did something she didn't usually do. She called her husband at the office.
Hello, dear.
Oh, hello, Henry. I'm sorry to bother you, but Miss Maxson said you weren't busy.
Oh, not too. I should be able to get home early today. Everything all right?
Yes.
You all right?
I'm fine.
Mink?
Oh, she's... Henry?
What?
Oh, nothing. I just wanted to talk to you for a minute. That's all.
Listen, are you sure you're all right?
Oh, yes.
Mink been getting on your nerves?
Not really.
Well, you tell her to behave, or when I come home, she and I are going to have a talk. As a matter of fact, she's been a little fresh lately, and I don't think it's good.
Well, she's playing outside. She's fine.
Honey, is something wrong?
Why, no, I told you I was just thinking about you and wanted to talk, that's all. Nothing wrong with that.
Not a thing.
You go back to your work, dear. I'll see you soon.
All right.
What time do you think you'll be home?
Oh, about 5, maybe a little earlier.
5? Oh.
Hey, what? Come on, what?
Well, I was just thinking. Nothing, really. Just Mink and you and me. Goodbye, dear.
You are okay, aren't you?
Yes, I'm fine. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Another hour passed, and it was 4:30. The day began to wane. The sun lowered in the peaceful blue sky. Shadows lengthened on the green lawn. Outside it was quiet. The two little girls more intent than ever upon their endless movement of design and pattern with the implements before them. Mrs. Morris watched from the window, and she had never known Mink to have such powers of concentration. She had turned on the radio and sat drinking a cup of coffee and turned over her thoughts.
Children. 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 Love and hate side by side. Sometimes children love you, hate you all in half a second. Strange children. Do they ever forget or forgive the whippings and the harsh, strict words of command? I wonder. I wonder, how can you forget or forgive those over and above you? Those tall, silly dictators. Those parents.
Mom!
Oh, what is it, dear?
Have we got a piece of lead pipe and a hammer?
Well, I don't know. They might be in the garage. What do you want them for?
We just need them.
Well, if you tell me what for, dear, maybe I can... Is something wrong?
Drill stuck halfway. If we could get him all the way through, it'd be easier. Then all the others could come through after him.
Well, can I help?
Thanks, Mom. I can fix it.
You better get through, Mink. I want you to take your bath before your father comes home.
All right.
Now, he's coming home early. And Mink! Mink!
Mink had disappeared behind the shrubs, and Mrs. Morris knew it was ridiculous to make an issue of it. Besides, what was the issue? Invasion? Drill? 0 hour? Unaccountably, a cool breeze came up, and although normally for that time of year it would have been a relief, Mrs. Morris felt a chill. She closed the window. Time passed. A curious, waiting silence came upon the street, deepening. Then from the living room, Mrs. Morris heard... Five o'clock, 0 hour. It had come, and now it had gone. But was the clock right? And Mrs. Morris, knowing how foolish it was, knowing it, went to the phone and dialed.
Oh, silly. It's silly.
Tone, the time will be exactly 4:54:20.
Four 4:54 and 20 seconds. And Mrs. Morris knew that it wasn't as silly as she had thought, because it wasn't 5 o'clock yet. Not 0 hour yet. Then the car drove up into the driveway.
Hi, mate. How's it going? Hi, Anna.
Hi, Daddy.
Bye. Hi, Mr. Morris.
Got a kiss for your old man?
Haven't got time now, Daddy.
Well, that's a nice thing. What are you doing?
We're playing Invasion.
Oh, swell. Your mother in the house?
Uh-huh.
Okay, be good.
I will. There are in a few minutes, Daddy.
All right, I'll be ready.
Mrs. Morris heard him chuckle. Then he steps up the walk to the front door.
Mary?
I'm in the living room, dear.
Oh, hi. Our daughter didn't have time for a kiss. How about you?
A hard day?
Not particularly.
Would you like a cocktail?
Oh, you read my mind.
Martini?
Perfect. Anything exciting happened today?
No. Oh, Helen called.
Oh.
From Danbury. I told her she was crazy, but she just felt like calling.
Like you calling me this afternoon. Crazy, huh? Hey, what was that all about?
Well, I told you. I just wanted to. Mm.
Hey, incidentally, what's this new game the kids are playing? Invasion. That's a nice, depressing thought. Is she all right? Come to think of it, she looked kind of funny.
She's all right. What's the time, Henry?
A couple of minutes after 5. Why?
No, the clock's wrong. By your watch.
Oh, I've got 2 minutes, too. I'm probably slow. You got something on the stove?
No, I just wondered.
Honey. Hey, look at me. What's the matter?
Nothing, really.
Now?
No, really.
Mink's been up to something.
No, of course
then
not.
What?
I guess I'm a little tired. Upset, that's all.
Do you want to go out for dinner?
Oh, no, I've got a steak here.
I'll tell you what, I'll barbecue it. How'll that be?
Oh, fine. What was that?
What?
Well, I thought I heard something.
Well, I didn't.
I must have been imagining it.
Hey, you are jumpy. Why don't you have a drink? It'll do you good.
No, I don't want one. What's the time?
Mary, what is this? Now, I mean it. Something's wrong, and I want to know.
Oh, it's silly. It's so silly. I'm on edge, that's all.
Mary.
I am.
I don't like this. That kid's done something, hasn't she? I'm going to get her in.
No, Henry, please, don't. She hasn't. It's nothing at all. I just...
What's that?
I don't know.
Those kids haven't got anything dangerous out there, have they? I noticed a lot of junk lying around.
I thought it was a game. She wouldn't have done it herself. They made her do it.
What the devil?
Well, maybe you better go out and tell them to stop playing now. It's after 5. You tell Mink to put off the invasion until tomorrow. Tell her.
It is coming from outside. What are they up to? I'd better take a look. Mink! Mink! Good Lord! Bombs! Bombs, they're bombing!
No, it's upstairs. I know it is. In the attic. That's where it is.
Mary! Mary, it is not up there! Mary!
He ran after her, confused, not a little frightened. She seemed to know something.
In the attic.
Her mind had worked that quickly. Any excuse to get him away from the outside, to get him upstairs to the attic in time. And outside, there were more explosions, and they could hear the children screaming with delight.
It is not in the attic, it's outside. Mink's out there, what's the matter with you?
No, I'll show you. Hurry!
Mary.
Get inside, quick. Now we're safe until tonight.
Are you crazy? Why did you throw that key away?
Oh, maybe we can sneak out later. Maybe we can escape.
For heaven's sake, the kid's out there. Do you want her to get killed?
Oh, you don't know. You don't. We've got to stay here. We've got to. It's horrible. We've got to. You've got to stay here with me.
At this point, I don't know how the devil I can get out. Where's that light?
Oh, be quiet. Please be quiet. They'll hear us. They'll find us. Oh, Henry, please.
Well, who's going to answer the telephone? There's that noise again. Oh. It's in this house. Mary, what is this? Mary, what's happening? You know, now answer me. Stop it, Mary, stop it. Somebody's downstairs. Who's down there? Who?
Oh, no. Oh, hush. Please be quiet. They might go away. Please.
And between his wife's terror and the electric humming from below, Mr. Morris felt a great fear. They trembled together in silence in the attic, Mr. and Mrs. Morris, parents of the little girl. Then they heard steps coming up the stairs and a voice. And a queer, cold light became visible under the door crack. A strange odor and the alien sound of eagerness in Mink's voice was almost more than they could bear. Each wanted to scream.
Mommy! Daddy!
And another sound. And the attic lock melted. Mink, with bright little eyes and tousled hair, peered inside. And behind her, tall, wavering blue shadows. Frightful shadows.
Suspense, in which Miss Eza Ashdown starred in tonight's presentation of Zero Hour. Suspense is produced and directed by Anthony Ellis. Tonight's script was written by Ray Bradbury and adapted by Mr. Ellis. The music was composed by Leith Stevens and Lucian Morowick and conducted by Wilbur Hatch. Featured in the cast were Parley Bear, Paula Winslow, Eve McVeigh, John Daner, and Beverly Hanley. Sound patterns were by Bill James and Ray Kemper. This is the CBS Radio Network.
Well, that about does it for this week's Savage Science Radio. Until we meet again, keep your powder in your pants dry, and happy trails to you. Going to leave you with a little instrumental Happy Christmas in honor of John Lennon.